Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Happy Monday. We're joined by Bill Kristol and Jonathan Last of the Bulwark. Thanks for joining me, starting another confusing, bizarre, probably pretty ugly week.
Yes.
Where do we start here? So we were actually discussing beforehand all the problems we're having with the internet, and the fact that I noticed that when I'm putting together my newsletter, I have a lot of browser windows open, and as a lot of windows open on the browser, and things have just slowed down incredibly. And you think about the load of all of the people that are out there using the internet because they have no place to go. And Jim Swift points out, think about the people working from home. Instead of having their dedicated T1 lines in their office buildings, they're at home plugging away, probably doing some of the same stuff. And then, of course, there's other things that people are doing with the internet. I just want to read one tweet here from a woman named Carlene. I don't know who she is or where it's from, okay? Pornhub gives young people an unrealistic and unhealthy idea of how quickly a plumber will come to your house. You know, people are learning things all the time right now.
Well played, Charlene.
Yeah, it really was good. Okay, so let's talk about what's going on here. I don't know where I want to begin. I have a piece up about the election here in Wisconsin, the shambolic pandemic election we're going to have tomorrow. I want to talk about that. I do think that that's a warning of where we are going. We also have the president continuing to act like almost like a snake oil salesman, pushing this drug. And I'm not going to, either one of you want to try to pronounce it, because I don't really, they haven't bothered learning how to pronounce it. Hydrochloroquine something.
Hydrochloronique, I think.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, if Rudy Giuliani can't figure out how to pronounce it or bother to learn how to pronounce it, I didn't think it was really worth my effort. I mean, by the way, for those of you wondering, where's Rudy? What crazy crackpot thing is he cooking up? Apparently, he's the guy who has been advising the president to go out and use the bully pulpit of the presidency of the United States to encourage people to use an unproven drug. So, Jonathan, just started with this. Can you tell me what is the obsession with this particular issue?
Well, the president's defenders will say he's just trying to give people some hope.
Yeah.
And I mean, this, it all just, it highlights how far out of the realm of normal we are. I mean, yeah. So did you guys listen to Queen Elizabeth's remarks on Sunday? Did you guys know?
Yeah, I did.
They're tremendous, right? But also, basically what you expect from every replacement level, whatever the Mendoza line is for a national leader in a time of crisis, they basically would sound like that.
Yeah, but she's not number one on Facebook.
Well, that's the thing. The fact that it is so utterly unthinkable that Trump could do that just shows you, like, what a weird place we're in. Nobody would ever have thought that we would have an American president who couldn't do that. And instead, we get a guy who is out saying, like, look, just take it. What harm could it do?
Which is the Queen Elizabeth thing. I grew up a little bit in my very, very early years in England. And at least family lore was that I was taken as a 6-month-old to Queen Elizabeth's, I don't know, coronation is the right word. I mean, she became queen in mid-1952, but there was the huge, like, thing, you know, procession and installation, whatever they call it, was in mid-1953. We had just arrived in England where my father, we lived for about 6 years. My father edited a magazine there, Encounter. And so allegedly I was there as a, you know, literally 6-month-old baby in a, what do they call them in England? A pram, I guess, and a little baby carriage. And so I've always had a slightly soft spot, special for Queen Elizabeth. But what's amazing is in her talk, she refers to, in my first broadcast, which is a radio broadcast, as a youth, I said X, or I can't remember how she brings it up, but she mentions it. So I looked that up quickly. That was in 1940. She was a 14-year-old, and she spoke to the other kids in, not just in Britain, but elsewhere, who had been either sent from London to the country, or people forget this, I think tens of thousands, maybe more British children, English children, British children, I guess, from the UK, were sent abroad to Canada and to sort of the Dominions. And she sort of says something reassuring to them that, you know, we will make it through this, as a 14-year-old reading a text, a script, obviously, that others had helped her with. But I mean, think about that, 1940. I mean, Churchill's giving speeches, De Gaulle's giving speeches, Franklin Roosevelt's, FDR's giving speeches, and she is still here. I mean, that's just the longevity is kind of jaw-dropping, isn't it?
Well, and it explains so much about you, Bill, that you became a royalist in your pram.
Totally, yeah. Now I'm rethinking it because it's, you know, I've decided the... No, I was always actually a Republican. I don't know. On those issues, I was never much of a nostalgic type for the... For the monarchy. I want to get back to, we'll get back to Trump and everything, but I want to take, can I just sort of hijack this for 10 minutes and
ask
Charlie about Wisconsin, because he and I have discussed this a lot off the air and, in emails, and we've had some stuff. Charlie has an excellent piece on the Bulwark this morning, but you're there in Wisconsin. You know Wisconsin politics extremely well. You know all the players in this. And what's happening in the election out there is really important and fascinating. And as you say in the piece, a real, I think, lesson for November. So say a little bit about, there's a primary tomorrow, so say a little bit about what's going on, what's happened, what's happening, what it feels like
there,
and your analysis of it.
Well, it's not just a primary. This is our general election. You have hundreds of mayor's offices, county board seats. You have a Supreme Court seat that's up on the ballot. And by the way, that Supreme Court seat is really crucial to understand what's happening here, because that's become a major division between right and left in Wisconsin. But you know, there is tremendous confusion here, and there is tremendous anxiety. I get emails every day from people saying, seriously, they want, you know, me or my wife or my mother to risk her life to go ahead with the polls. And so as a result, both parties, and I know that I'm getting accused of both sides, both parties have really screwed this up. The governor, Tony Evers, has been very, very feckless. He issues a, stay-at-home order, but then up until Friday, he wants to go ahead with the election, and then he changes his mind on Friday and then wants to change the rules. The Republicans have been far more consistent. They just don't want to do anything. I mean, they are turning down anything, making it easier for mail-in ballots. They're going right to the wall. They've gone to the U.S. Supreme Court to ask them to not even extend the deadline for counting and submitting absentee ballots. So this is, I think, a preview of what we might see in the fall. For anyone who is naive enough to think that there was going to be some sort of good faith bipartisan reform adjustment to the pandemic by making it easier to mail in, I think you're seeing the partisan rancor here. Trump has made it clear he's going to go all out against this. The Republicans here are absolutely adamant. And so let's give a little bit of a backup on all of this. It's so bad that in the city of Milwaukee, where there are 300,000 registered electors, there may be only 5 open polling places tomorrow, unless something changes.
It's unbelievable to me. I mean, what?
5.
The Republican position for tomorrow, I mean, there's a little bit of back and forth, you should say, sort of some blame on both sides kind of thing. And so you can see, that, well, we can't just put this off at the last minute and it's too late to do the mail-in ballots with security and so forth. I don't think that's quite credible, but whatever, that's their position. But what is amazing to me is it seems like the Republican Party, from Donald Trump through Mitch McConnell down to state legislators in Wisconsin, their position literally going forward is, we don't care if there's a pandemic. We're not going to adjust the way we're going to run the election in November. And we're just going to ask people to risk their well-being by voting. If you're in a state that doesn't already have vote by mail, it doesn't have easy vote by mail, it doesn't have easy absentee voting and so forth, we're going to just, we're not going to accommodate, because we're so invested, I guess, in what, not letting people vote easily? I think
it is kind of the worst of all possible worlds. You have hundreds of thousands of people who will not come out and vote or can't figure out how to vote as a result of all of this. But you will still have the public health, potential disaster of people coming out and, in fact, exposing themselves. I think a lot of it has less to do with the principle than just sort of the real politic. And again, I want to go back to this Supreme Court election. Republicans, the conservatives have a 5-2 majority on the state Supreme Court. And I won't explain why this is considered to be absolutely crucial, but it has been here in Wisconsin. And there've been a lot of anxiety that the incumbent conservative, whose name is Kelly, would not win re-election, because there would be so many liberals and Democrats who would come out and vote in the Democratic primary for president. In fact, they were so worried about this that back in 2018, remember they had that lame duck session where they were going to strip the governor of all those powers?
Right.
One of the things they wanted to do was change the date of this election to make it easier for Kelly to be reelected. They actually toyed with all of that. And up until very, very recently, they were absolutely convinced that they knew that he was vulnerable because that the Bernie Biden thing was so intense that there would be a massive turnout of votes in Milwaukee and Dane County, and that might swamp him. There's not much they could do about that. Now everything has changed. But I do think the calculation they're making right now is there's this window here where it looks like Republicans have, Republican counties are overrepresented in the absentee ballots, big numbers out of Waukesha County, big numbers out of Washington and Ozaukee County, less so in Milwaukee and Dane County. So this is the sort of raw politics. They figure if they go ahead with this election, they can win this state Supreme Court seat, which is a 10-year term. And, look, I know these guys in the legislature, the leaders of the legislature, and they are very smart. They are very able legislators. They are also incredibly arrogant and incredibly partisan. And so I think they've made the calculation that, number one, it's in their interest to go ahead with this as opposed to making any accommodation. And then, of course, you just have sort of the Trumpist Republican position, which is that mail-in ballots lead to fraud. And frankly, that they don't like the idea of really big turnout. So you kind of have this perfect storm of awfulness here. And I'll be honest with you guys, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I always vote in elections, or almost always vote in elections. And I tried to apply for an absentee ballot last Friday after they extended the deadline. I don't even know where it went through, whether it went through or not. I don't know whether I'll get it in the mail today or tomorrow. I have no idea. And if I don't, am I going to go and stand in line at the polling place to vote for maybe one or two things that I vaguely care about? I really don't know. And if I don't know, imagine being a senior citizen who's been told to not leave the house, who gets the absentee ballot and has to find someone to witness it. That's the other thing. You can't file the absentee ballot without having a witness. So what if you live by yourself? What if you, feel the need to actually stay at home and not have contact? So there will be hundreds of thousands of people, I think, in the state who will not vote tomorrow who otherwise would have voted.
And obviously, if you're a lower income, a single mom, and you're less familiar with, how to search the website to apply for these ballots, you don't have access to maybe to someone else who's happy to sign for you. You've been told to stay home and shelter in place. I mean, it's even harder. Upper middle class people probably can figure out how to do this more easily. So I think it is. Clearly, the Republicans are making a very hard-headed calculation that their voters will navigate this better than Democratic voters. And what's amazing to me, again, I think it's very bad what's going to happen tomorrow, but the idea that going forward, they're just going to defend for months, not changing, not making it, not accommodating voting to the pandemic we're in. I mean, it really is, I can't believe they can actually sustain it in some ways. I can't believe that state legislators are going to look their constituents in the eye and say, sorry, we're not going to make it easier for you to get a mail-in vote, because net, ultimately, it probably helps our party a little bit to make it harder to vote. I mean, this is a country that, we voted in 1864 in the middle of a civil war. We've gone out of our way to always get soldiers and others overseas ballots in 1944. My father told me this. I think I remember him saying this, that I can't remember if he voted, or at least he, some sure. of his buddies when they were in, I guess at that point in France or Belgium on their way into Germany, voted. It'd be their photos. I searched this for 10 minutes, online. I mean, there are photos of soldiers sitting in front of tanks, in World War II voting. We got people ballots in Vietnam. We have about 2 million mail-in ballots every election, every presidential election, of just currently deployed, military, diplomats, businessmen abroad. So the idea that this is like un-American is a little ridiculous. But I mean, is the Republican Party going to seriously take the position that?
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. I mean, they won't even break a sweat. This will become an article of faith for Republicans that this is an attempt for the Democrats to steal the election, that it would be massive voter fraud. You cannot actually do this. And look, it doesn't take that many votes in Wisconsin. It's like if they can suppress 23,000 votes. I mean, let me back up here. Remember, Trump won this election by only like 70,000 votes in four states, three or four states. Yeah. So, you know, the difference that this makes could be decisive. And that's the way they're thinking. So they'll go on talk radio. They'll go on Fox News. They will demonize the idea of mail-in votes as massive fraud. And the base will go along with that.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. I mean, we'll see. So the biggest, just so people know, I mean, what's going to come up, there'll be a big fight over whether the federal government should provide more funds. They provided some in the first stimulus to states to make it possible. Because it's not easy if you're not already a mail-in state, or let's say an easy excuse for early voting, absentee voting state, or in the case of Wisconsin, for example, I mean, to change from requiring a signature to other ways to verify the ballots. You know, a signature of a neighbor, which is pretty onerous, especially if it's the last minute. There'll be a big fight in the next this month on what the federal response is. And then there'll be a state by state slugfest. Now, there are states with Democratic governors. In Wisconsin, the Republican legislature has a lot of power, it seems, over the elections. Other states, I gather, the governors or the secretary of state have a little more discretion. And some of these Democrats are simply going to do it, but there'll be lawsuits. I mean, the degree to which we're going to have
a mess.
And really, I worry, leaving aside the partisan character of it and the kind of shamelessness of the Republicans, I really worry that in early November, we'll be having an election that the legitimacy of which, if I can put it that way, will be under a cloud. It will be like watching some third world country having an election where there's wildly disproportionate turnout because of the way the government has jimmied the rules, you know, from different regions or different ethnic groups or so forth. I mean, we're used to seeing this abroad to some degree. We're not really used to, I mean, ever since we've mostly removed the barriers to African-American voting in the South, obviously, we're not really used to seeing this here. We used to seeing it at the margins. You know, you get these fights about, obviously, every election, but that's pretty marginal. And the degree to which we're going to have an election that's going to be anyway, it's very worrisome.
No,
it's a civic matter in addition to the partisan question. You know?
Yeah, JVL, I think one of our big hopes is that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that it's in November, but this thing may not be over in November. We may be waving the bloody shirt about this election for decades. Mm.
You know, in a lot of ways, this reminds me of the Merrick Garland fight.
Oh, God,
And that this is, in a way, for those of us who, you know, I would say I was conflicted on the Merrick Garland stuff at the time, and have become, in hindsight, convinced that it was an enormous mistake, and that it was a really terrible thing for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans to have done. And this feels like it is an extension of that, a sort of chucking of all norms whatsoever for the sake of pure power politics. And, you know, we were concerned about the legitimacy of the November election to begin with, because we have a sitting president who could very well say, you know, 3 weeks leading into the race, boy, you know, I'm not sure if I'm going to respect the results of this. You know, we're just gonna have to wait and see, which is, you know, something he did 3 years ago with the election, 4 years ago with the election. So it's very, very dangerous ground. And if we're not going to be able to ramp up ways to have alternative pathways to voting, then the answer is going to be to make sure that all of the polling places are open. And if it results in a public health catastrophe, then so be it, because the Republican Party needs to be dismantled.
So I think what's going to happen, evidently, is, I mean, the way this will work rhetorically is the Democrats will say, we need to have, you know, make it easier for people to vote. The Republicans will say no. In early October, Republicans or Trump will look up and say, you know, it's dangerous for people to go vote, and maybe we need to postpone the election, which would be kind of jaw-dropping. Charlie, you've been very worried about this for a while. Mm-hmm. I think they'll do that sort of knowing that there'll be a huge reaction to that, and everyone will say, we can't do that. And then the Trump and Republican position will be, okay, well, then we just have to go ahead. We got to have the election we can have. We can't change everything on October 15th. We can't invent a mail-in system. So we're just going to have the election we have. And you know what? If turnout's down a little bit in the inner cities where people are less used to absentee voting or mail voting, and they're less, it's less easy for them to get the ballots and fulfill the various, you know, jump over all the hoops you have to get your absentee ballot in correctly. And incidentally, where unfortunately the virus may be stronger in dense inner cities. And so it's just a little too bad if people in Milwaukee or Philadelphia or Detroit have more trouble voting. And that's going to be the Republican position. And again, that is Merrick Garland on steroids, I would say.
Yeah, this is Orbanism. This is how it begins.
And I have to ratchet this up. So by the way, while we have been talking about this, I figured, you know, look, I mean, I ought to be able to figure out whether I'm going to vote absentee or not. So I did look it up. And amazingly, I did request an absentee ballot. My request was filed on April 3rd. The ballot request was received on April 3rd. Yeah, based on it. So they claim they mailed it to me. So we'll see. Okay, so let's shift gears just for a moment here. So JVL, let's talk about the numbers, what we're looking at in terms of the models, the trend lines. You had a really alarming piece the other day. There are the truthers out there, of course, who are insisting that all of this is being exaggerated, that there are not as many deaths. I think the evidence would suggest that there are more deaths from the coronavirus than have actually been reported. The president and others are saying that there's some evidence that maybe we are flattening the curve. What are you seeing? Because you've been watching this very closely.
Yeah, there is some evidence that the curve is beginning to flatten, which is good. The University of Washington's model has been revised down by, they pulled 12,000 deaths off of their median variant scenario, which is good. To give you some sense of scale, so exactly 1 week ago today, we went over the 3,000 death mark. Those are the official deaths. At some point today, probably early afternoon, we will go over the 10,000 death mark. So that's a 333% increase in 7 days. The good news about that is that the doubling rate itself is slowing a little bit. We had been doubling every 4 days. Now the doubling is close to every 5 days. So what we're looking at is you're looking for the rate of increase to slow, right? You're still increasing, but the rate starts slowing. Your DXDT changes a little bit. The problem in all of this, though, and the New York Times ran a deep dive on this weekend, which I was happy about because I've been ringing this bell for weeks now, is that we believe, based on anecdotal reports from doctors and public health officials, that the true number of coronavirus deaths is much higher than the recorded number. And that's because we still don't have an availability of tests. And so people who are admitted to the hospital who are very symptomatic may not be tested to begin with because the doctors feel like they don't need a test. They know the person has it. And then if that person dies, they don't have the time or the ability to do postmortem testing. And so if there isn't a positive test attached to a death, the death is not counted as a coronavirus related death. And anyway, so you've seen the Wall Street Journal had a deep dive on this in Italy last week, where in Italy, it looks like the true number of coronavirus deaths in some towns might be two or three times the number of
officials. Two or three times.
Yeah.
This is much. We're not saying you're off by 50%. You're saying you're right. Off by 200-300%.
Yeah. So, but there's no way of knowing. So what the journal looked at was they looked at Bergamo, Italy, and there they took the total number of deaths in March of 2019 and compared it to the total number of deaths in 2020. And it was like a 4x. But on the other hand, only one of those only one of those multiples was officially ascribed to coronavirus. And so, so what happened here? And there's no way of knowing. Now, somebody will at some point in the after action report here do a very deep dive statistically. They'll look through the listed cause of death, and anybody of a certain age will be whose deaths are attributed to like respiratory failure but not to COVID-19. They will sort of run regression analyses and figure out exactly what's going on and come up with some sort of model. But the reason we care right now, the reason I bring this all up, is that it's not academic, because if you don't know the total number of true deaths, then you can't actually know whether or not your rate is decreasing or not now. Do you see what I'm saying? Unless you're getting a true accounting of both the numerator and the denominator here, you don't know. And the danger is we don't want to keep the economy shut down for a minute longer than we have to, but we also don't want to open it up a minute too soon because we don't want to risk a relapse, right? And a secondary outbreak. So you need good data to be able to get to as good an optimal point as possible, and our data is not great.
And this also goes back to the pivot that the president made a week ago, where he did say you did back off the Easter date and did appear to be taking the science more seriously. And everybody was saying, like, he finally gets it. That lasted how long? It lasted about a week, because over the weekend, very clear that he's already getting impatient. There's already now pressure. There's kind of the drumbeat. You can feel this, you know, out there, that people are saying, you know, okay, the moment this thing looks like it's ticking down to a certain level, is he simply going to declare victory? And, you know, tweeted out this morning that there's light at the end of the tunnel. The problem is, of course, this is a huge country. The rates are very uneven, aren't they? That you could have the curve flatten out in places like New York while exploding in places like Chicago and Detroit. But I think the risk is still there for a premature reopening of the economy. And it will, and it could, certainly knowing Trump, it could be driven by politics and by these voices in his head rather than by what scientists like Dr. Fauci are telling him to do.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And, you know, the other thing that you've seen is, you know, the number that he threw out last week, 100,000 to 200,000 dead is what they're expecting. It also looks to me like they are trying to set goalposts way, way out far, so that if there is, you know, if 99,000 people die, he will claim total victory and claim that, you know, he personally saved millions of lives. And that sort of thing drives me a little bit crazy, because yeah. It's one thing to be wrong. I mean, look, I think that this represents the failure to stockpile tests during the 12-week period we have between the virus appearing in Wuhan publicly and a virus making landfall here in America is the greatest presidential level failure we've ever seen in America, ever, period, the end. But, you know, I could even excuse that if he would simply own up to it and, like, pivot to, you know what, we're going to get things right. But instead of admitting his mistake, he's now trying to lie more and position himself to be the hero of the play. And I find myself driven to distraction by that.
I mean, I would say one thing also on this that's dangerous is this. So let's assume, I don't know, we partly can reopen in June or July. And June 10th is when the Maryland and Virginia, the governors have sort of said, as of now, they're kind of hoping that things start to get back a little. They're able to relax the sort of shelter in place type or pretty strict rules we have here. But of course, we can't reopen everything for everyone right away. We shouldn't and we won't. And once we reopen partly, there's going to be a lot of judgment calls about reshutting down some things or recalibrating, because we've seen this already abroad with the places that are ahead of us, Hong Kong and stuff. But it's just common sense that the absent a vaccine and absent perfect knowledge of who's had the virus and whether having had it is, you know, inoculates you or not, we're going to be doing this a little bit blind, even with the greatest developments we could possibly imagine and testing and so forth over the next 2-3 months. And so a smart, you know, a responsible government is going to have to be honest with the citizenry and say, okay, we think we can do this. Oof, look, we need to take a couple of weeks here and cut back some, right? Just like any other. But of course, Trump's rhetoric is so much on the other side of this, is we're going to open up and be roaring back. Is he going to do the responsible thing in September, October?
Exactly. If
the evidence actually indicates that it's very important to prevent a real resurgence, to close down certain parts of the country, certain flights, certain sporting events. No. So this is Jonathan's point. It's not just that he was irresponsible or, you know, made some mistakes, that, as you say, given the unprecedented character, this maybe you could semi-excuse for a while, though not really with his rhetoric and stuff, but still. But now he's being totally irresponsible going forward, and it's going to make it very hard for Tony Fauci or Scott Gottlieb or the people who are sensible and know a lot to say, very hard for them to get a hearing. And Trump is laying a predicate for really irresponsible behavior in the fall, I feel.
And this is why it's so significant that the cult has already started going after Dr. Fauci. Look, I could see that if he did open it up, that anybody that would raise their hand and say, you know, Mr. President, this is dangerous, you're doing the wrong thing, will be demonized. Look, over the weekend, they fired the captain of a, you know, U.S. Navy aircraft carrier for writing a letter sounding the alarm about the health and safety of his own men. And this is an extraordinary story. And of course, they're accusing him of encouraging panic, panic being the key word that if you sound the alarm or you warn people about this, you're accused of spreading panic. And I think that's going to be one of the patterns. Okay, I want to talk about this blame game thing as well.
Can I say a word about this? I'm
sort of obsessed. Yeah, sure. Please do. No, please do. Please do.
No, I mean, I followed this one pretty closely, and I'm sort of interested in it. And he did try to raise this in the chain of command. One of their lines is, he should have raised this in the chain of command. He raised it repeatedly, got nowhere, sent this letter with a lot of people copied on it. You can quibble about whether that was the right, you know, was the situation so dire that he had to go to this rather extraordinary means, but it wasn't that extraordinary. What happened? The letter got leaked. Oh, that never happens anywhere in the military or in the world. And he didn't disobey orders. The idea that this was some kind of mutiny on the Bounty is ludicrous. The guy doesn't simply get investigated or reprimanded or told, you know, this is questionable, we need to look at this. He's fired. I mean, no, it's very rare for them to be fired immediately. Normally there are investigations and then people get fired. He's fired by the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who's a civilian. He went to the Naval Academy and served 7 years in the 80s, but he hasn't been in, and, you know, that was his entire naval experience. Over the opposition of the CNO and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who don't want him fired. And now this morning, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who's a businessman, goes to the ship and gives a speech attacking the guy. So it's exactly what you're saying, Charlie. It's not just that they're not going to do the right thing. They're going to demonize and attack anyone who stands in their way or tries to behave responsibly. And so we're looking at, what, 6-8 months of this way of running the federal government with respect certainly to the virus and, of course, other things as well. We saw this before in Ukraine. I mean, the degree to which we're really entering an election season where all the normal kind of constraints and guardrails on misbehavior by the president and his allies seem to have been eroded is really worrisome. It's really dangerous.
Yeah, well, with the caveat that nothing ever makes a difference, I have to say that one of the most dramatic pictures that I saw from last week was that the send-off that Captain Crozier got from his men, who clearly adore him, support him, think that he is a hero. And for a president that has built his brand around, I support the military, that was a bad image. And we've talked in the past, you know, endlessly about, you know, what would erode support? You know, if some key respected members of the military spoke out against that, and that, of course, never really has, well, it has happened, but it hasn't moved the needle at all, to use that cliche. But that scene, I thought, was that was a PR disaster for the Navy, and it certainly didn't help the Trump administration. Jonathan?
Yeah, and it doesn't help that it's reported that Trump was going around saying, I want this guy fired. And the real problem in all of this, you know, I would say almost everybody would be willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt in here, because we do believe deeply in the civilian-controlled military and the chain of command and yada, 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 except that Trump has gone and meddled in these sorts of things plenty of times just on the behalf of guys who've been convicted of war crimes. I mean, the whiplash you get from seeing the president going out of his way to meddle and pardon soldiers who've been convicted of war crimes.
Oh, I know that contrast. And
but where he will also reach in to punish then as a guy who is out essentially sacrificing his career to try to protect his men. The contrast is so striking. It's one of these things where I begin to not be able to understand how people are on the other side of it.
No,
if you're part of the Trump cult, how do you rationalize the two? I could see you rationalizing either side of it. I can't understand how somebody could rationalize both.
So, in terms of the blame game that we're talking about, and the way that the Trump folks are spinning it, one of the obviously central narratives is it's all China, that we ought to blame China. And obviously this is effective, because if in fact, you know, this is cast as this is something that was done to us, we are the victims. That obviously shifts responsibility, doesn't it? And the reality is, the Chinese appear to be, you know, bad actors here. And I guess my question is it possible? I think it is. It's possible to hold these two ideas in your head at the same time, that the Chinese did it, that the Chinese lied about it, the Chinese need to be held responsible for it. But also, this has been, as you point out, Jonathan, the worst presidential failure in American history. And over the weekend, and I certainly don't want to finish the podcast without mentioning this, the number of stories we have gotten about the squandered opportunities, the incompetence, the 70 days wasted, it has been just devastating. In any normal presidency, this would be definitively the end of the presidency, just from the material in that Washington Post deep dive. But they're going to try to blame it on the Chinese, won't they?
You know, can I just, I mean, they are, and they do deserve a lot of blame. And what's sort of heartbreaking almost about it as a conservative, if that word still means anything, but it has for a while, is we were anti-China. I mean, the Weekly Standard, you know, all of us, I think individually, were critics of excessive accommodation or rosy thinking about China. We were hawks on China, if I can put it that way, in various ways. So in a way, this is a confirmation that that authoritarian regime, and I think authoritarian regimes generally, can't be trusted, will lie for the short term, will endanger the rest of us, as they did. So in that respect, a conservative or hawkish, let's say, point of view has been vindicated. Incidentally, yeah. The failures of the CDC and the FDA, which were pretty serious, I would say, in late January and February, are also a vindication of a certain kind of conservative skepticism about bureaucracy and about how they get a certain kind of embedded point of view, which the CDC was, you know, we're better at doing these tests than the WHO, which I think in some normal circumstances they apparently are. But in this case, obviously, they then didn't, they got it all screwed up and then didn't fix it well and went along at a kind of bureaucratic pace of vaguely trying to fix it for a whole month. That was terrible. Now, the president's responsible for the CDC and the FDA. They're part of the administration, but still. So there's plenty of grist, if I can put it this way, for normal pro-free market criticism of bureaucracy, anti-authoritarian points of view here. And I think those, what's terrible, unfortunate, is that those are going to get discredited too, because, you know, Trump is sort of vaguely saying them and his supporters are vaguely saying them. And so you know, it's a real throw the baby out with the bathwater type of thing. And obviously we trust Dr. Fauci more than Donald Trump. Doesn't mean that Dr. Fauci is right about everything. Doesn't mean that every institution of the federal government is right about everything. They deserve criticism and reform often, but any sensible conservative reform agenda in all these areas has been so damaged by Trump and Trumpism.
You know, can I say here, Charlie, this is another case where, so even let's pretend that we're going to blame China for everything, which I'm happy to blame them for huge parts of this. They seem to have cut the entire world's throat with the way they mismanaged and lied about what was going on. In addition to just the way they treated their own public health professionals who were trying to sound the alarm, it's just horrible behavior. Okay, so if you believe that, what has Trump done about China over the course of the last 3 months? The answer is all he has done is alibi this regime and spread their propaganda.
Yep.
So even if you take that that faith, then you you ought to be able to say, okay, well then here's two. The American president was derelict in his duty and deserves to lose his job.
No, you're right. Let me just pick up on the sort of the reference to Dr. Fauci, and this may seem like a slight digression. Maybe I'm going back to where we started in the beginning about the weird snake oil salesman aspect of all of this, because Dr. Fauci is really seems to be the key player in this entire drama. And over the weekend, we heard that bizarre story. Axios broke the story about the confrontation in the Situation Room between Dr. Fauci and Peter Navarro, who is the crackpot who is in the position of the chief trade negotiator. And by the way, remember where Peter Navarro came from? It's because Jared Kushner Googled him or something, Googled one of his crackpot books and decided, hey, this would be a guy to have in the White House. And people who know him from the San Diego years are going, you got to be kidding me, you know? But he's been one of these guys who's pushing this this unproven drug and is apparently very, very influential with the president and all of these decisions, and very, very anti-China, by the way. So he's pushing this drug, and Fauci pushes back against him, saying the studies that you are talking about, that you're citing, are all anecdotal. They don't rise to the level of, you know, verifiable science. Well, he was on, I don't know if you guys heard this, he was on with CNN's John Berman this morning, and it was one of those, I feel like we should have Tom Nichols on the podcast. You want to talk about the death of expertise. John Berman is asking him about his credentials to hand out these medical scientific studies. And here's the exchange where he explains that he's not a real doctor. He doesn't even play when he's a PhD. He's a social scientist. Let's just play that.
In terms of the studies that exist, I think you would grant me that there are numerous studies on this which show preliminary therapeutics.
Let's I know three. Clear. Hang on, Peter. John, Peter, no, I, no, I, hang on. I have to ask a question. I let you go to 4 points at the beginning. I just want to follow up. You're saying a second opinion here. What are your qualifications to weigh in on medicine more than Dr. Anthony Fauci? Why should we listen to you and not Dr. Fauci?
Well, let me suggest, John, that later in the day you have William Grace on, another famous doctor in the city of New York. He can talk eloquently about this. But, John, doctors disagree about things all the time. My qualifications in terms of looking at the science is that I'm a social scientist. I have a PhD, and I understand how to read statistical studies, whether it's in medicine, the law, economics, or whatever.
John.
All I'm asking for you to understand, John, is that right in your city.
So here's some more of this, John Berman and Peter Navarro.
Be a plumber and read that and come to the same conclusion, John. Peter, I don't know why you're so hard about this.
Would you take it
if you got sick?
Would I take it if I got sick?
Would you take it, knowing what you know now?
No, I would listen to my doctor about whether or not
That's
I should
exactly
take it if I got
you
sick.
Do.
I would consult
That's
my
exactly
doctor.
What you
I would
do.
Not consult someone involved with
do.
Trade policy.
We're taking
I would not
29
consult with someone with trade policy, Peter.
I agree.
And my question, do
I'm
you
not
want a doctor?
Anything.
Do you want a medical
I'm
doctor, an internist?
Anything,
do you want an internist? Striking trade deals with Asian
Touché.
Countries? Well, no,
but
that's my point.
But you're setting up a false...
JVL, I feel like we should have Tom Nichols here with us to talk about the death of expertise, because, I mean, that's a cringeworthy moment where you're having the guy going, well, I'm a social scientist, which means that I'm qualified to advise the country on these drugs. One of my favorite quotes over the weekend, by the way, was, I guess somebody asked somebody from the American Medical Association, the president says, you know, what have you got to lose? And she says, your life. But I don't know. It seems so strange that this has become this culture war over the use of a drug, as opposed to, you know, when, and 99% of the people weighing in on this have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, including the president. This is like the reflexive anti-Trumpism, right? So Trump says something that is patently crazy. Everybody knows it's crazy. A bunch of people who are anti-Trump flip out about it. And then the anti-Trumpers go and try to nitpick and find some potential way that you could interpret one part of what he said as not being crazy, and then say, see, look, they're just obsessed with him.
Can we talk about anti-Trumpism?
And
Yeah, sure.
But can I just ask you a question? Because here's my real question. Was the Peter Navarro hit an authorized hit, do you think,
yes,
on Fauci?
Yes.
Because clearly,
he's
talking to an audience of one in this segment. He is talking to the president himself. And is he doing that because the president deputized him to go out and attack Fauci? Or did somebody else let him off the leash and tell him to go after Fauci? Is this a Jared move?
Well, this is interesting because, I mean, obviously, Trump is embarrassed by the fact that that Fauci is publicly not backing him up. This is clearly a real obsession of the president to push this drug. And it was an interesting moment yesterday, wasn't it, when the media asked Fauci, well, what do you think about this drug? And Trump wouldn't let him answer. I mean, he would not let him answer the question. So Peter Navarro knows that he's scoring loyalty points by ripping on Fauci. This all makes me incredibly nervous. I mean, not to, first of all, just the lack of scientific rigor here, but also the willingness of this president to throw the actual experts under the bus. We talked about this earlier in the podcast.
Yeah, and no surprise, frankly. I mean, this is his move. This is, this is Trump University, right? Everything is Trump University. The great lesson of the Trump presidency is that Trump University wasn't the outlier. It was the model.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. Okay, so anti-Trump. For people who don't understand the term, this is a thing. It's this class of pundit out there that doesn't want to say I'm pro-Trump, but spend all their time attacking anyone who criticizes Trump. That's the anti-Trumpism. And our friend Christian Vanderbrook had an interesting tweet thread about this, and he sort of sums up anti-Trumpism, you know, as someone who says, "I don't support Trump. I just want the people who oppose him to fail." You know, and so you'll get people like that troll, Stephen Miller, who will go, I'm really not in favor of Trump, but he spends 99% of his time tweeting attacks on anyone that's crossways. And so this, can I just read you what Christian wrote?
Yeah, please.
He goes, and I put together his tweets sort of in my newsletter. One point I'll give to the anti-Trumpers, he writes, their main objective is not to promote Trump, even if they're okay with that outcome. Their primary concern is to protect other Republicans and conservatives from the consequences of their Trump support. Part of that entails exiling and marginalizing anyone who openly rejected Trump. It's why they are so threatened by the Romneys and the Bulwarks. They want the heir to Trumpism to be someone who bent the knee. Why? Because that's what their friends plus colleagues did. Taking a principled stand hurts people who work for politicians and organizations that cannot afford to be principled. Anti-Trumpism is how you remain in good standing with the establishment. It's how the swamp adapts. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I do too. I would stipulate that for as many, you know, different varieties of anti-Trumper as there are as many stars in the heavens. But a big part of it is, in fact, the preservation of access to social networks and money and job and career opportunities. Because, you know, if you couldn't bring yourself to just get on full hog and become a Trump supporter, then you can still basically stay in good standing with those people by just beating up on those who oppose Trump. Like, right. that has turned out to be good enough.
And there's always material, so that if you're a conservative media type like I used to be, you'd get up in the morning and go, "Can I defend Trump? No, I absolutely do not want to, you know, kiss up to this guy. But do I have something about AOC that I can use? Can I find somebody in the media who's done something stupid? Can I find some unfair criticism?" And there's always something. So that's the anti-Trumpism. And it's kind of a comfortable place. We know a lot of the people out there who will then claim, "Well, I'm not for Trump. I didn't support him. I'm not one of those people. I'm not one of the Kool-Aid drinkers. It's just that I will attack anyone who endangers the Orange God King."
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, the other part of it is that there is an avoidance of following things through to their natural conclusions if you do that, right? Because the big cognitive problem of becoming anti-Trump is that if you're anti-Trump, then at some point you got to start reckoning with, well, okay, so hold on. So what does this really mean? Am I still a true conservative, or is conservatism now something that is different than what I believed in? And I mean, you see what I'm saying? There are a lot of that road can lead to a lot of places that people are not comfortable doing. And I understand that. I don't know. This is why I don't know. I think the anti-Trumpers are actually much, much worse than the pro-Trumpers. I much prefer the Bill Mitchells of the world who just are in for a penny, in for a pound, you know, who are just going to say, "Look, can we all just agree here that if fewer than 200,000 people die, then President Trump did an amazing job?" Like, that's better from where I sit. That's more intellectually honest and more of a defensible position.
Of course, he's insane.
Well, sure. But then sitting around and being like, the real problem here is the media, right? Because the New York Times has published 4 million words on the coronavirus in the last 12 weeks. And I was able to find 4 articles that are stupid. You know, like that sort of thing. Like, you know, like what you got that idiot over at the Examiner who did last week, Beckett Adams, you know, as if the media is the institution that's really failed America over the last 12 weeks.
I want to come back, but I'm going to make my shot on Bill Mitchell, who I think is completely insane, though. Did you see his latest tweet?
I did.
He keeps moving the goalposts. Like, okay, the last one was, "Well, death is sad for the living left behind."
Right. Now, it's fine. So he goes from, like, you know, nobody's dead, there's only 16 people dead, to, like, nobody's dead, there's only 256 people dead, to, like, look, probably there will be fewer than 200,000 yesterday, where he goes, I mean, really, shouldn't the living envy the dead?
It is merely a passage out of this physical body to a spiritual existence, free of this mortal coil. If one turns off the radio, the music is still there.
He says, how do we know that the dead don't pity us, the living?
Well, you know, you mentioned the media cherry picking. Over the weekend, Kathy Young did this incredible deep dive. This is a hardworking young woman.
Yeah, that's a great piece.
Did a thing about, and what's great about Kathy's piece in The Bulwark, people should check this out, is that she has no illusions about the groupthink of the media. I mean, she understands, you know, why conservatives have been disillusioned with the media over the years, but then goes through the specific criticisms. And really, it is this sort of, you know, bad faith art form of cherry picking a couple of things, say, see, the media is hypocritical or biased, when in fact, of all the problems that we're facing with this pandemic, the legacy media is not number one, not number two, not number three, not even in the top 10.
No, and in fact, I'd go the opposite direction. The legacy media, by and large, with obvious exceptions here and there, because nobody's perfect, has performed admirably over the course of this crisis. And in fact, if you could have only one of two news sources for the last 12 weeks, you could either have listened only to things uttered by Donald Trump or only things that you read in the New York Times. Which would give you a better understanding of reality right now? And it's not close, right? I mean, and it's so not close that it's not even worth entertaining. Well, that's just your opinion, man. You know, I mean, this is. And anyway, but this is, again, the way that people who don't want to defend Trump go about getting out of attacking him, is they just find something else and pretend that, well, you know, the real issue, well, we're having our third 9/11 in 8 days. The real issue is the media. And it's just, again, give me Bill Mitchell any day.
So I was checking out your newsletter just now, and I noticed something that I had not actually realized, which I should have realized. Both, you know, I have a newsletter in the morning, you have a newsletter in the middle of the afternoon. By the way, if people have not subscribed, they ought to, because we have three newsletters every single day. Morning Shots in the morning, The Triad by JVL in the afternoon, and then, of course, Jim Swift, Overtime. We both of us, though, in today's newsletter, linked to this this piece in the Washington Times by Ethan Epstein, who used to work for the Weekly Standard. You write, my friend Ethan Epstein has written his final column for the Washington Times. Now, I didn't realize this was his final column, because it really was a sort of on the way out how Trumpism has corrupted conservatism. So this is his last. He's done. This is his goodbye to all that.
It is. He's leaving the Washington Times and going off to a career. I'm not going to say it out publicly because I don't know that it's public yet. But he's going on to take another job. And this is what's striking about this is Ethan was never down with Conservatism Inc. to begin with. Ethan was always a reformicon. He spent a lot of time sort of studying and listening to conservative talk radio. And among the people at the Standard, I mean, he and Chris Caldwell were the most sort of open, well, and myself, frankly, the most open to Trumpism and to Trump.
Trump curious.
Yeah. And just sort of like, okay, well, you know, what we've been doing hasn't really worked great. And the sort of Chamber of Commerce version of the Republican Party hasn't done super awesome. Maybe we ought to look at some alternatives. And what he does in his final column is, you know, whatever this is, it isn't what conservatism used to be. It's much more like what Mao and Lenin did, where we have, you know, the Republican and conservative position now is to simply deny reality and to hope that you can turn your own dreams and wishes into existence merely by a force of will. And it's really, it's something. It's a tremendous, tremendous essay. People ought to go read it. And Ethan was the first one who went and pointed out to people that there was never a China ban, right? This is, you know, Trump rose around, you know, I banned travel from China. And he didn't. Ethan, right. In fact, in Ethan's piece about this, you know, he went over to one of the super duper Trumpers over at Hudson. And this guy did not realize, you know, this policy expert, that Trump had not banned travel from China. And he quoted in Ethan's piece. It's like, oh, really? I did not realize that. But there were still fights coming.
This was a central part of the Trump defense that he acted quickly. He shut down the borders, but because that was his, you know, one thing. You have to have, you build a wall, you shut down the travel. When in fact it turned out he didn't. Now, what was the story over the weekend? And this is the problem, is that the media is doing a great job, but the stories come too fast. It was the New York Times that reported that, 400,000 people flew here from China after the quote unquote China ban?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this is one of these cases where I think it's since the outbreak of the virus, since the ban itself. But, you know, they're like daily flights from Air China have landed in America every single day since the China ban. And this is one of these things where, you know, if we get the worst. As always with Trump, you find yourself in the sour spot of the worst of all worlds, where you get the xenophobia, but without the actual lockdown of the borders, which might have slowed the spread a little more. It's again, you get the authoritarian impulses without the actual hands-on control of the executive branch of government in a way that makes it functional and prepared to deal with crisis. You get the worst of everything. You get the incompetence of a banana republic mixed with the aspirational authoritarianism of Viktor Orban.
So JVL, it's just Monday. We are already at three times the death toll of 9/11, which, by the way, offends those numbers, offend the anti-Trumpers. But these numbers are, we're over 10,000 now, right?
We will be later today. When we came on the air, we were at about 9,800 deaths. And so we're getting there. Depending on how bad things go, it is possible that 10 days from now, we could be at 3,000 deaths per day. Yeah.
Well,
and we don't know that's, again, you know, it all depends, but this is where we're looking.
Well, wash your hands, stay safe, do whatever you need to do. Where do you come down on wearing masks?
So I am hugely in favor of wearing masks if people do it smartly, because what they don't understand is that the mask isn't to keep you from getting coronavirus, right? Mm-hmm. You know, unless you have like an N95 respirator, the mask is to keep you from spreading it in case you are asymptomatic. Oof. Like this is, and so, you know, I see people walking around, you know, the Target parking lot this weekend who have a mask on, but so that their nose is over the top of the mask. And I'm like, and this is my great fear. I just did the commentary podcast this morning. My great fear is that we're going to move from sensible lockdowns in an attempt to suppress the spread of the virus into something like virus health, public health theater, where we will wind up with stupid rules and regulations which do nothing, in much the same way that like the TSA turned, you know, actual airport security into security theater.
By the way, that's a perfect analogy. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, yeah. And that is what I worry about.
You go through the it's a form of signaling, kabuki dance, nobody takes it seriously. I just think that people's patience will come to an end, and there'll be like this massive jailbreak that we get to a point where people just can't take it anymore.
Well, maybe some of you people. I'm such an introvert that this is the greatest moment of my life in terms of like being. If I had my druthers, I would be sequestered for decades at a time.
Well, I'm not going to argue with it. No, I mean, seriously, I mean, I'm way more introverted than you because I have no kids in the house right now. So just dogs and my wife. So
it sounds beautiful.
Well, and the house is big enough that I can be downstairs most of the time. So, all right, JVL, thank you. And Bill Kristol had to jump off. Thank both of you for being on the Bulwark podcast. And again, this is Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.